Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
I guess I would just argue that people aren't doing those jobs because they're doing lower jobs because they're lazy or because they don't want to work harder. They're doing a job like that because they don't have the financial ability to pay for more schooling, to do other jobs that are paid more. When what if we valued all jobs equally in society? Like, what if we totally changed the way society was structured so that, you know, it wasn't about what you have more money, you can get a better paying job. It was more about, like, all jobs are doing something for society.
That's the voice of Zoe Luber from Stop Dem Evictions Burnaby. On this week's show, we speak to Zoe, dispelling many myths about poverty and homelessness and how to move forward. So stay tuned. You're listening to Latin Waves. Online, I have Zoe Luber. She's an organizer with Stop Dem Evictions Burnaby, coordinated by the Alliance Against Displacement, a political organization building dualities between working class and indigenous communities to dismantle capitalism and colonialism. Stop Dem Evictions Burnaby is fighting mass gentrification in the Metrotown neighborhood through grassroots resistance, including public meetings, protests, and occupations. Welcome to the show, Zoe.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, no problem. I just wanted to talk about poverty issues in general today, because this week I was very disturbed to get some feedback from different colleagues and people I've run into about what causes poverty. There seems to be this belief that poverty is because people made bad decisions or are just not motivated or lazy. Can you talk a little bit about what would be some of the main factors causing poverty in an individual or family?
Yeah, of course. First of all, before going into the factors, I agree 100% with what you're saying. I've had really similar experiences with a lot of people who really individualize poverty, and instead of putting any of the blame on the broader systems, which I'll get to, people blame the individual. You know, they blame someone who's homeless for not working hard enough. They say, just get a job. You're just lazy. You've made bad choices. And really, like, the reasoning and the root causes behind poverty, you know, why homelessness in Metro Vancouver is at the highest it's ever been in 2018 and since ever, it's because of capitalism and colonialism. It's because of, like, our broader economic systems and neoliberalism that kind of put, you know, they put profit above people. They stagnate wages and government programs that are, you know, were created during, like, the welfare state to support people have all been gutted because of austerity. So now wages are stagnant. There's minimal government support. So people are struggling, and rents are, you know, we're in a housing crisis too. And we can't separate that from poverty and from homelessness. We're in a current housing climate when rents have increased or are legally allowed to increase the highest they have, the largest jump they've made in 15 years, 4.5%. And vacancy rates are still rock bottom. So there's just, you know, most people are spending most of their income on renting. Most people are unable to buy poverty, and most people have to, you know, work two, if not three jobs to survive in Metro Vancouver. So we're at a real crisis point. It's not because people aren't working hard enough. It's because the system, you know, no matter how hard you work under capitalism, like, you're never going to, you know, accumulate wealth, because as long as you're selling your labor to the capitalist class, like, they're always going to be the one accumulating most of the wealth, most of the capital, and you're going to be stuck in a vicious cycle of working every hour of the day as much as you possibly can just to sort of make it by.
Now, you've touched on many things just now, and the person I was speaking to this week was a business owner. He was lamenting that if the minimum wage increases, people will be just content and happy with the minimum wage, and these people are already working very easy jobs, so there'll be no motivation. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I've definitely heard similar arguments against a minimum wage increase, and I've heard similar arguments, you know, against labor struggles, against people wanting to form a union and fight for better. They say those jobs are easy. those jobs don't deserve higher wages. Those people are lazy. They're not working hard. All of that. They're not intelligent. They're whatever. Like a lot of really derogatory remarks towards people who are making minimum wage. And I guess in response, I would encourage people who think that way to consider sort of the broader idea of work. You know, like work isn't just what you go, you know, into the office to do. Like work really, I think we need to contextualize work in a broader sense. Like work really is, you know, it's raising a family, it's preparing food, it's walking kids to school, it's raising children. Some of it is waged, some of it is unwaged, but all of it is work. And the stuff that we're doing so that we can do the parts of our lives, the work that is not waged, like family care stuff for our broader family, that kind of stuff like that. We need to have the waged labor be at a level that will allow us to do the work that we're doing outside of our waged labor jobs. Does that make sense? I'm like, I would argue that any job we're doing, they all, you know, support people in some way, you know, whether it's going to a restaurant and eating a meal with family and friends, or whether it's getting your taxes done, or whether it's, I don't know, buying a product from Apple or getting your computer fixed, any of that stuff, all of it in some way contributes to society. So to rank jobs in terms of, you know, some jobs being quote-unquote more difficult, it's not so much that they're more difficult, it's that they require more education to do those jobs. Say like the tech industry, or, you know, like, I don't know, other, like more, like, you know, working in a lab, you know, being a professor, getting a PhD, all of those, they're more difficult, but only because they require more education to get to those jobs. And to get that education, to get those jobs, like, you need a certain level of wealth or a certain level of financial security, even if it's the level of credit you need to be able to, like, apply for a student loan. Like, if none of your family has gone to post-secondary, like, for you to even to go to college or to go to, like, a one-year trade program, that's a big step. So the wealth factor and the class factor really plays into the job. Like, you can't, like, it's not about skill. It's about class ability and where you're at because of the way capitalism works and the way the system works. Some people, if they're just, they can't afford to go to pay for the amount of schooling that's needed to require jobs that right now are valued more in society, which I think is quite, you know, it's quite disturbing to me. So I guess I would just argue that people aren't doing those jobs because they're doing lower jobs because they're lazy or because they don't want to work harder. They're doing a job like that because they don't have the financial ability to pay for more schooling, to do other jobs that are paid more. When what if we valued all jobs equally in society? Like, what if we totally changed the way society was structured so that, you know, it wasn't about what you have more money, you can get a better paying job. It was more about, like, all jobs are doing something for society.
Absolutely. And, you know, even working at, like, the 7-Eleven now, you need a college degree, computer skills. And I'll tell you, I work at the university, and the janitors who work at the university are the lowest paid and they work the hardest. So this idea that if there's a higher minimum wage, people would just be really happy with staying at a McDonald's job is just ludicrous. Now, something else that came up was people on welfare or homeless people are just sitting around having a good time and enjoying this money coming in. Can you talk about the life for someone on welfare, how much money they get to survive, and also dispel the myth that people who are homeless get any income at all?
Yeah, for sure. So, like, welfare in BC and PWD support in BC, like, they were frozen for, at least welfare for sure, was frozen for 10 years. And I think the BC NDP increased it $100 when they first came into government, which is still, like, you know, you're living at, like, 800-ish a month, which is completely unrealistic for, like, the cost of living in Metro Vancouver, especially if you take into account that, like, the shelter allowance if you're on welfare is, like, $375 a month. You can only stay in places that charge you $375 a month, which is, like, almost you know, almost nowhere. Like, your housing options are severely limited, and that's even if you are housed. So my first argument, I guess, that it's not easy to get by on welfare. Like, living on welfare is not easy money. Like, I talked to someone recently who, a friend of theirs, just got went from welfare to PWD, and that extra $300 a month, like, that's going to make a huge material difference, but they know they're still going to be poor. They're still going to be working class. They're still going to, like, really, really struggle to make ends meet and go hungry many nights, because you just can't get by on $1,000 a month in Metro Vancouver anywhere, not even in the Fraser Valley, where it's supposed to be more affordable, or on the island. Nowhere is affordable on welfare or welfare PWD on, like, a government stagnant, like, subsidy, like, wage. Like, none of that's affordable, like, for anything. And my second part of the argument, I guess, is that, like, people who are on welfare and people who are homeless, like, they're not, like, they face, like, a lot of brutality and judgments and, like, harshness from the rest of society. Like, they're not just, like, happy-go-lucky, like, chilling around, like, folks receiving money from the government. Like, just, I would draw your attention and the attention of your viewers to, like, the situation with Nemegan's Nation in Saanich on the island. Like, that tent city of homeless people faced eviction from the BC NDP, various ministries of transportation and housing and environment, three different times, pushed off land that they weren't even living in houses on. They were camping on it. Like, right now they're forced to, like, pay for camping at provincial campgrounds, and the Ministry of Environment / like BC Park / like the city of Saanich have actually banned anyone outside of the homeless population who are living there to even go into that campground at the Goldstream Provincial Park. So, like, people can't even bring them food. Maybe they've had to move three times in the past week. And that's the kind of, like, day-to-day brutality homeless people face in Vancouver, in Metro Vancouver, you know, Maple Ridge, on the island. It's really intense. It's not a free ride. It's not people being lazy. It's, like, some of the people who, like, face the absolute most adversity and are surviving despite that. It takes an incredible amount of strength to be homeless. I think most people couldn't manage it because it's really hard.
Absolutely. And we're in the 21st century, and it just makes my blood boil to know that we have these tent cities, and it's becoming a problem where people don't even want to see people in a tent city. Well, where are they supposed to live? You know, they can't even go to the park, and it's just such a crime. Can you talk about how hard it is to just maintain a residence on a low income in Vancouver? Because this is a problem right across the country. What's happening? And talk about how gentrification is just making it harder every day for average people just to survive and make a living.
Yeah, of course. Like, I could look to, like, the neighborhood of the Metrotown neighborhood as an example of how difficult it is to get by on, like, either, like, a subsidized wage or, like, a low wage job. Like, as of the 2016 census, the average, for example, that median income for that neighborhood, and this is, like, a low income neighborhood that's being redeveloped, was around, like, $20,000 per year. And, like, they're developing it intensely, and the city is trying to use a lot of kind of PR moves. So they're saying they're putting in non-market housing, but all of the non-market housing units, and there's not very many, just a couple hundred, when thousands of units of affordable housing are being destroyed, all the non-market, so supposedly affordable units going in, they're all at something called BC housing income limits. So, like, you would need to make, you're not allowed to pay over 30% of your income for your rent. So you have to make a certain amount, because the units are around, like, $900 a month for a one bedroom. So it ends up equaling that you would need to make you need to earn per year around $30,000 to qualify for a non-market unit in the neighborhood, and the median income for that neighborhood is $20,000. So, like, that shows how inaccessible, like, a non-market subsidized unit is for someone who's working a low-wage job or for someone who's on government subsidy. Like, it's just not feasible. I do work with a lot of janitors for, like, I work for a union, and, like, most janitors in Metro Vancouver have to work 2 to 3 jobs. Like, they work 2 full-time jobs, and then they work a weekend job to survive, to feed their families, to pay rent, you know, to pay for public transit, whatever, like, all of that stuff. Like, and everyone I talk to, just all we talk about is how expensive it is to live in this whole area. It's not just Vancouver. like low-income people, working class people are being priced out of like the whole, like any urban center. Like there's just, there's no, and then if you go outside of the urban center, there's no jobs. So people commute, you know, like commute an hour, 2 hours, like in from Delta to like clean a building downtown. Like people work like 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. and then work like 5 p.m. to 1 in the morning and do it all over again 7 days a week. And that's like a norm. That's become a norm under late stage capitalism and neoliberalism. It's very disturbing. It's almost impossible to even have one job anymore. Like most people I know work at least two jobs or live like in, you know, in abject poverty.
It's absolutely frustrating. And you know what will come up if a conservative was listening to this? They might say, hey, where's all the money going to come from to pay for the social housing or the supports that people need? How would you respond to that? Where's the money going to come from?
Yeah, I would point to wealth redistribution, and that can be done through increased taxation on corporations and on the wealthy. You know, like you look at like Gene Swanson's proposed mansion tax and other forms of like progressive taxation that like take more money from the people at the top and distribute it to people who are being kept in poverty because of a fundamentally unjust system. Like most, you know, like it wouldn't even take a lot to redistribute wealth a little bit more. I mean, there's so many people living in poverty or close to poverty in these cities around Vancouver, but there's also like a lot of people who have so much, you know, like people that needs to be redistributed to people who need it, because a lot of people who are able to own three homes and invest and flip property, like they didn't work hard to get that. They were born into that level of wealth. So we really just need to like redistribute. And also, like, you know, you can take funds that, from budgets that are really overinflated, like police budgets. Like the city of Surrey spends like, I think it's 43 cents for every dollar on their RCMP. It's the largest RCMP force in all of Canada in Surrey, the RCMP detachment there. And like, what if we were to take some of that money and put it into social housing? Because right now, like policing, it's not building homes for people. It's actually making a lot of people feel less safe.
What a lot of people don't understand, Zoe, maybe you can back me up on this, that the cost of doing nothing is actually quite high. So can we talk about the economics of doing nothing?
Yeah, for sure. Like I haven't yet looked into like exact numbers for like what this multifaceted operation in Saanich, and I will speak to that because it's like the most fresh in my mind, of costing. But I am sure that to deploy like the Oak Bay Police, the Victoria Police Detachment, and the Saanich Police Department, like three different police forces onto a group of 40 homeless people three separate times, like with massive bulldozers and like emergency response teams that basically look like are basically the size of like army tanks, like that is costing way more than housing people. Our figures from like a few years ago were like, it costs roughly like $200,000 to build like one unit of social housing. And now it's probably definitely a bit higher. So even if it's like $300,000 to roughly build like one unit of social housing, if you look at like, you know, city budgets, like the city of Burnaby has like $1.8 billion in its budgetary surplus right now. Like they could build like, I can't crunch those numbers in my head, but they could build a lot of housing. Right. And like, if you look at, I think it's, somewhere in the interior has modeled the housing first model, when you first build housing and then you deal with addiction and mental health support and psychiatric care and all that kind of stuff. But like a primary factor with people is housing. It's stability. Like there was a letter to the editor published in the Times columnist, I think in Victoria, that talked about someone who was living in that Penn City, Camp Nemagans, before it was displaced, and they started going back to school. They were upgrading. They were prepared to like figure their life out and help improve things. And then as soon as the tent city got smashed for the first time, they were this homeless person was registered for another course. They'd finished a full course when they were living in the tent city. That teacher never saw them again because they lost their housing stability. So like, it makes sense to invest money into housing, because housing is a primary need that people need to, you know, improve the rest of their lives. And the amount of money that's being spent on like heavily like institutionalized, like medicalized, like supportive housing. I'm like, first, let's just build housing because people take care of each other. Like, we see it in the 10 cities. Like, they support each other. Like, first of all, we just need, like, people to have, like, a safe and secure home. And that actually, like, if you look at how much money the government and the state has, like, it doesn't actually cost that much. The money's there. It's just the political will is missing.
Yeah, we have, it's absolutely a tragedy. We have young working families becoming homeless, and then you become very sick when you're homeless and exposed to the elements. You end up in the hospital. We have free healthcare, and then we put people back on the streets. It's kind of lunacy that we can cover healthcare, but we can't make that decision to be humane and be neighbor. There are neighbors, there are human beings, and we can't make that decision. So if you had a wand, what would be your horizon for the future? What would be a perfect scenario in your eyes? What do we need to do?
I think we need to work more to target the root causes of homelessness and of abject poverty, and that's like through, you know, interrupting and fighting against capitalism and colonialism. And I think we can do that by building up collective power. You know, it can be done through supporting struggles that are already there. Like the amount of, there's been definitely community backlash and sandage, but there's also been a lot of community support, you know, like housed folks stepping up to like pay for the U-Haul that will help transport the homeless people's stuff to the new tent city site when their old site got displaced, like that kind of stuff. Like, you know, in like, it's not an individual act, but I think recognizing where struggle exists and then working to fight with those people and help and redistributing all that you can to keep those struggles going. I think organizing and, you know, building up power in working class and indigenous too, because colonialism is like a huge part of this as well. And that's why there's been so much force against the tent city on the island, because it's predominantly indigenous homeless people. It's a real threat when indigenous people stand up. The Canadian state feels very threatened. If you look back at the Oka crisis and various crises, like there's various like militarized operations against indigenous people, it's a definite pattern. So I think just like going forward, like we don't have like a utopia post-capitalism, you know, mapped out, but like to get there, you know, to dismantle these systems, like we need to fight, and it's going to be a fight, but it's a fight 100% worth fighting.
Yeah, we absolutely have to care about each other. And if someone is in the Burnaby or Metro Vancouver Burnaby area and wants to get more information or see how they can help you guys out, how can they be in touch with you guys?
Yeah, I would say email's the best. If they were to email organize@stopdisplacement.ca, and we then we'll happily get back to them. Like, we're involved with community struggles in Burnaby, in Victoria, in Nanaimo, in Saanich, in Maple Ridge, in the downtown east side area, in Surrey as well. I'm trying to think if I missed anywhere. I think that's it for us. Well, we're geographically very spread out, and we have folks fighting on the ground and working with communities, fighting it back against capitalism and colonialism in all of those areas. So please send an email. We'd be happy to chat with anyone who wants to get involved.
And any final words for someone who's not in this region, because this show goes right out across North America, who might be in the audience, who's just feeling the squeeze financially with housing, or maybe has insecure employment or low wage employment, and they just feel so alone. Any advice to those people?
Yeah, I think the advice I would give is just to like build connections and to fight back. You know, even if you're working a service industry, like precarious job, like in North America, like you have the right to unionize. Disrupt capitalism that way. Like find the areas of struggle. You know, maybe there's a homeless encampment close to where you live. Like, go and talk to those folks. Find out what they want to do. Organize a press conference. Call the media. Like, it's really, to get involved in organizing is actually like really not a hard thing to do. And I think it will help people feel not alone, and not like it's their fault that they're struggling paycheck to paycheck and worried about next month's rent, because most of us are, because of the way capitalism works. So I would encourage people listening to this to like get involved in a fight, you know, fight back. So at the end of the day, it's all we have to fight. Otherwise status quo will continue, or things, you know, the status quo won't even continue. It will just get worse. they'll just get more and more uneven and unequal. And, you know, right now, 8 people have more wealth than the bottom 50. In a few years, it'll be 4 people owning more wealth than the bottom 50. So unless we do something and, like, really, like, fight back, then the state and the system will just take more from people who already have close to nothing.
I want to thank you for your time today and encourage people to look in their communities for resources and other groups of people in the similar situation who can work together. And I thank you again for your time.
Thanks so much for the interview. I really appreciate it.
Got a couple of minutes left, so we'll take you out with David Rovick's song, We Are Everywhere. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.
When I say the hungry should have food, I speak for many. When I say no one should have 7 homes, while some don't have any. Though I may find myself stranded in some strange place with naught but a vapid stare, I remember the world and I know we are everywhere. I say the time for the rich, it will come. Let me count the ways. Victories are hints of the future. Havana, Caracas, Chiapas, Buenos Aires. How many people are wanting and waiting and fighting for their share? They hide in their ivory towers, but we are everywhere. Religions and prisons and races, borders and nations, FBI agents and congressmen and corporate radio stations. They try to keep us apart, but we find each other, and the rulers are always aware that they're a tiny minority, and we are everywhere. With every bomb that they drop, every home they destroy, every land they invade, comes a new generation from under the rubble saying, we are not afraid. They will pretend we are few, but with each child that a billion mothers bear, comes the next demonstration that we are everywhere. We are everywhere.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement.